On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Comcast fights back against cord cutters. The GPON Armageddon is upon us. Don't trust your hotel room. And NetBees lets you see exactly what your users are experiencing on your network. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 289, recorded May 4th, 2018, NetBees Performance Monitoring. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Duo Security. Give anytime, anywhere access to applications based on the trustworthiness of users and devices with Duo Beyond, the Zero Trust Security Platform. Sign up for a free trial at Duo.com. And by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/Twiet. And by MoveSoft. Reduce IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%. Visit MoogSoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professionals, the IT pros, and the geeks who just want to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the geek in paradise currently at home because he's just recovering from major surgery, folks. But you know what? He knew that neither rain nor sleet nor cut tendon will keep a good geek from delivering the tech news. Chibert, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm okay. The constant throb in the calf muscle is not much fun. Sadly, if it had been surgery, it would have been done, big pain and then done. But now it looks like I'm going to be on crutches and a cane for probably like 4 to 5 months.
Yeah. We should probably mention that Chibert is on an awful lot of painkillers. So this could be fun.
Yeah.
Now, someone who isn't currently on painkillers, at least I don't think he is Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, you are in yet another temporary location. What is going on with you?
Well, I'm not on painkillers, but I am in Las Vegas, which in many ways is the same sort of thing. So I hope that this works out well. I'm actually coming to you from the Mirage Hotel, where I've been at Interop ITX all week. It wrapped up just a couple of hours ago. Interesting show. Missed you and Brian, of course, but a good show. And now I'm just looking forward to getting back to what I think I'm going to call the Sunshine Studio in beautiful Orlando, Florida.
Well, Chibert, Curtis, good to have you both. And we've got a heck of a show for the Twiet Riot. Not only are we going to be talking about a little bit of news and the blips and the bites, but we've got NetBees who, they want to help you answer that question. Is it the network? But before, as we always do, let's go ahead and kick it off with the blips. Now, with Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, and dozens of other online content providers making cord cutting more the norm than the exception, traditional content delivery companies are feeling the squeeze of increased competition and a shrinking customer base. Now, there are many ways that a business can respond to those challenges. You could increase features, roll out new programming, buy exclusive, offer lower prices, or just provide a superior customer experience. Of course, if you're Comcast, there's another option. Just force the cord cutters to buy the cord. Last week, Comcast customers in Houston, Oregon, and Washington were informed that Comcast has increased speeds for free. 60 megabit per second plans became 150. 150 megabit per second plans were upgraded to 250, and 250 megabits per second plans were upgraded to 400 or 1 gigabit per second. The catch? You have to subscribe to a bundle that has both internet and TV service. Now, this is a response to a definitive downward trend in Comcast video subscribers. In 2017, Comcast lost 151,000 video subscribers. In just the first quarter of 2018, they've lost another 96,000. with their internet subscribers at 26.2 million and rising, and their video subscribers at 22.3 million and falling. This is what Comcast is doing to stem the bleeding. Company reps are framing this as a free boost for Comcast's most loyal customers. But a quick analysis shows the real reason why Comcast is willing to offer premium combo packages at the same or lower prices than internet alone. Comcast owns a content network that only makes money from TV subscribers. This threat from such a vertically integrated company is exactly what many of us screamed about when Comcast was purchasing NBC. And it seems that 5 years after we first mentioned the threat on Twiat, it's finally happening. Expect this sort of aggressive pricing to continue and accelerate across the market as ISPs tie the future to the past for profit.
Hey, being tiny, it's not going to protect you. Think your simple IoT devices don't have enough power to interest criminals? A new report from Trend Micro says that pretty much any computing device, no matter how low powered, can be a target for cyber criminals trying to make money through illegal cryptocurrency mining. Underground markets are awash in cryptocurrency malware, including those targeted at devices with relatively low processing capabilities, such as consumer IoT products, smartphones, and routers. Several of the tools are also designed to steal cryptocurrency from Bitcoin wallets and from wallets for other digital currencies like Monero. Now, prices for these tools range from under $5 for Flux Miner, an Ethereum miner, to $1,000 for some miners like Decadence, a software product for mining Monero. Now, a product like Decadence, for instance, will start at just $40, but can cost up to that $1,000 when features like graphics processing unit support, a web-based control panel, remote access capabilities, and encryption services are added. Sounds just like enterprise software. Now, while it's unclear just how much currency hackers can mine with IoT-based miners, the researchers say crypto mining is fast becoming one of the top threats to individuals and organizations as criminals look to compromise systems for use in mining.
Well, talk about the ultimate yuck. In a very unusual move, police detectives in Largo, Florida, recently went to a local funeral home and located the body of a man named Linus Phillip. The 30-year-old had died days earlier at the hands of a different Largo officer. The detectives then attempted to use the fingers on Phillip's body to unlock his own smartphone, which had been recovered from the scene. The efforts were not successful. So, just to put you at rest, most fingerprint readers actually won't work after a couple days after you pass away. As you go through the embalming process, your fingerprints actually do change, the amount of moisture and so forth. Also, some of the more advanced fingerprint readers and biometric readers actually do require that there be some pulse behind that fingerprint. So you can't just hack off a person's thumb and use it to unlock their phone or any kind of high security installation. In other words, yuck.
This is why fingerprint readers don't work for me, because I am a robot. Now, speaking of robots, this past Monday, April 30th, the VPN Mentor blog published details of two vulnerabilities in GPON, or Gigabit Passive Optical Network Routers. CVE-2018-10561 described a way to bypass authentication and directly change settings on the router by simply appending ?images/ to the URL. CVE-2018-10562 is a command injection vulnerability. Together, they would allow an attacker complete control over how a router was configured and what software it was running. Well, in just 3 days, those concepts were turned into in-the-wild attacks with devastating effects. According to NetLab, a division of Chihu 360, exploits started yesterday, and now over a million GPON routers are under attack. Most of the attacks are centered in Asia, as they are the most likely markets for fiber to the premise, and NetLab has identified at least one command control center in Vietnam. This is an ongoing exploit with no quick fix, so stay tabbed.
Once again, it's time to change your password. Just in time for National Password Day came news that Twitter was alerting its 330 million users to change their passwords after it detected a flaw in one of the internal logs that, as it turned out, was storing passwords in plain text. Twitter says that it's fixed the bug, and there's no evidence that the log file itself was compromised in any way. Still, Out of an abundance of caution, the company decreed new passwords for everyone. Now, for enterprise IT people, this is a warning to be careful of where in the process you're gathering log data, how you're storing it, and just how long you're going to keep it around.
Well, recently, the FTC warned Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft about illegal warranties. Hyundai, HTC, and Asus received warnings as well. Last month, the FTC sent letters to six companies informing them that their product warranties were violating U.S. law. There are some exceptions. Under the 1975 Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, voiding a warranty because a customer didn't use a specific part or repair provider isn't generally allowed. The FTC called out six companies for warranty language that did just that, though. Required certain parts or services to be used in order to preserve a warranty. The agency didn't say which companies received letters, but Motherboard filed a Freedom of Information Act request and found that Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo, Hyundai, HTC, and Asus were the recipients. Each company received a similar letter. Warranty language that implies to a consumer acting reasonably under the circumstances that warranty coverage requires a consumer to purchase an article or service identified by brand, trade, or corporate name is similarly deceptive and prohibited, said the letters. And the specific wording found to be in violation of the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act was called out in each individual letter, which kind of makes me wonder whether or not our friends at the FTC are also going to hit Apple for their insistence that you have to use Apple-branded touchscreens and LCDs for repairs on iDevices.
Last week, little-known company Point View Tech, LLC, filed with the FCC for permission to broadcast millimeter wave signals from low Earth orbit. That in and of itself is interesting, but what makes it more interesting is the fact that Point View didn't exist early last year. It was only recently formed, funded, and mandated to develop LEO internet tech. And it's a wholly owned subsidiary of Facebook. In early 2019, PointView will be launching their Athena satellite atop an Arianespace Vega rocket, about the same size and weight as the SpaceX Starlink satellites proposed by Elon Musk. Athena will be able to achieve speeds of 10 gigabits per second, an order of magnitude above its still mythical competitors. This first satellite will have three ground connections, one in Ventura, California, one at the Mount Wilson Observatory above Los Angeles, and one in Northridge. Interestingly enough, Facebook has three job openings currently at a new Northridge office for those with satellite communications experience. Now, if Athena lives up to the hype, and if they can hit their 2019 launch, then Facebook might have an insurmountable lead in the LEO-delivered internet market. And for a company trying to spread beyond the current population served by the internet, it's a big deal indeed. Well, that does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites, and we've got some doozies that you're going to want to pay attention to. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, on the show, you know that we've talked a lot about persistent authentication. And we all know that there's this internal tension, a conflict between making it easy for your users to access what they need to access and making sure that those who are not supposed to be in those data lakes and forests don't get easy access to those datas. Well, folks, that's why I'm so happy to have a brand new sponsor of This Week at Enterprise Tech, their first week on the show, and it's Duo. Now, Duo is the leader in zero trust secure access for the enterprise. Duo simplifies the path to zero trust. Remember, we're all into zero trust. Always authenticate. BeyondCorp security environment. A Duo Beyond allows secure communications and connections to all applications based on the trustworthiness of users and devices. It allows you to set and enforce risk-based adaptive access policies. It allows you to get enhanced visibility into users' devices and activities. You know exactly what's going on and what devices are being used to get data. You can embrace mobility and BYOD all while making your users happy with frictionless secure access. Now, Duo Beyond grants access to cloud and on-premise apps without clunky VPNs or MDM. It provides a simple and effective way to adopt a zero-trust security model in your enterprise without alienating your users. You can establish trust in users' identity. Duo Beyond verifies the identity of all your users with effective, strong, multi-factor authentication before granting access to enterprise applications and resources. It extends visibility into users' devices and activities. Because with Duo Beyond, you get visibility into every device used to access corporate applications, whether or not the device is corporate managed. That just makes sense. Even if it's their own device, even if it's BYOD, you should know exactly what someone's iPhone or tablet or their personal laptop is accessing when connected to your network. That means there's no need for device management agents. Duo also ensures the trustworthiness of devices by inspecting all devices used to access corporate applications and resources in real time at the time of access to determine their security posture and their trustworthiness. It also enforces risk-based and adaptive access policies by protecting every application. Duo Beyond can define policies that limit access to those users and devices that meet your organization's risk tolerance levels. Finally, Duo Beyond enables secure connections to all of your applications by granting protected applications on-premise or cloud-based through a uniform, frictionless interface accessible from anywhere. It's Duo Beyond. It's zero trust, complete confidence. Now, here's what we want you to do. We want you to see if zero trust is the next step in your network security. Adopt a zero trust security model today with Duo Beyond. Visit Duo.com. That's Duo.com. To learn more and to sign up for a free trial. Once again, that's Duo, Duo.com. And we thank Duo for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it. This is a story that we sat on for a while. We could have talked about it last week, but we wanted to find out a bit more, allow some more of the details to make it out. And of course, we need to talk about that hack of hotel room and cruise ship touchless keys. Now, you know that most hotel rooms and even cruise ships will now use either the RFID or the magstripe cards. In fact, the magstripe cards are really on their way out. Well, two researchers were able to generate a master key from just looking at some of the data blobs coming back off of the Ving card targets. Now, the interesting thing about this thing is that they don't really need to hack, and they don't really need to understand exactly what the data blob contains. They were able just to estimate what the next data blob should look like, and the next data blob. And using a small device with a software-defined radio and an RFID transceiver, they were able to generate master keys that allowed them to get into every room in a hotel. Now, Chibert, this is interesting tech because, well, although it's an advanced form of entry protection, we also know that most hotels and most cruise ships don't actually have networked locks. So if there's a fix to be made, it has to be done door to door to door. You can't just push a button and update the firmware of all the locks to get rid of this exploit. In fact, in many cases, these locks will never be able to be updated.
Yeah, well, here's the trick. Every single proximity card, even mag stripes and so forth, they all have something in common. They usually have what's called a facility code. Now, in order for the cards to be able to be used throughout a hotel and be easy and so forth, they actually don't even bother with serializing the cards. All they're using is a so-called secret key, which is the facility code. And that's what these hackers are doing. They're actually finding old discarded cards, reading them quickly to get that, you know, facility code, and then adding in the checkout date and a few other pieces of information by simply guessing and playing it back. It's actually not a hack at all. It's a playback of the data. And because there's no network, there's no way to update except by going physically to each lock. Changing all the locks in a hotel is actually quite cumbersome. One of the other things that a lot of hotels haven't done is they're kind of dealing with inertia. Even though most of the new proximity code locks have the ability to serialize the locks so that, you know, if you just play back an old proximity card, it's not going to work because it's only for a specific lock. The problem is a lot of hotel registration systems don't have the ability to store those serial numbers. So the whole industry is going to have to change and kind of get up to date. Now, when you start talking about the enterprise, most enterprise lock systems like the ones from Assa Abloy or Kaba or Stanley and places like that. Those systems have had the serialization from the very beginning. They've also gone one step further by putting in an encrypted hash, usually an AES 256 hash, so that it's next to impossible to do these playback attacks. But the warning that I'm kind of throwing out there is that if your facility manager hasn't really caught up and they haven't implemented those hashes, you may be just as vulnerable as a lot of hotels are.
Right, right. Now, we should point out the fact that a lot of the lock systems used in large enterprises are not these types of locks. They're far more expensive, and they're typically networked. You actually made a comment that if you look at what it costs to deploy, say, a hotel lock, where basically you're removing something that was there and you're adding something with some electronic components, versus, for example, what's working in your lab, where you're going to run power and probably data to every lock, the costs are prohibitive. It's a big jump to go from kind of secure to very secure.
Yeah, and there's not that much in between. Now, my lab is actually using a sort of in-between system. It's wireless based, so there's a gateway that I have on a physically isolated network. It is running in the 2.4 gigahertz unit band, but it only uses a single channel. It is frequency agile, so it's actually jumping channels in some sort of pattern that I have no idea how they do it. But my locks still talk back to a central server with a SQL database to store the entire audit log. And it also stores the hash, the AES hashes and so forth. And it also does rolling code. So that's kind of really cool. And the best part is if you're in a heavily unionized town, say like New York City or Chicago, whatever, the cost of running the conduit to put the connections in for power and communications into these door locks could in some cases be 10 times more expensive or even 100 times more expensive than the cost of the locks. So that's why Stanley, used to be called OmniLock, now it's called Stanley, has been selling these wireless solutions so that you only have to pay for conduit for the gateways, and each gateway can handle, say, you know, 16 to 20 doors at a time.
Now, Curtis, of the three of us, I think you probably spend the most time in hotels. You're always traveling. You're always going to conferences. There's been a temptation for the press to sensationalize this and say, oh, my God, everything that you have in your hotel room is unsafe. But as a frequent hotel stayer myself, I always thought that. I just knew that my hotel room was not secure. And I also knew that the safe inside my hotel room wasn't secure. This doesn't really affect the frequent business traveler, does it?
No, I don't think it does. The people that it's going to affect the most are the occasional pleasure travelers, the vacationers, who might tend to carry things like jewelry with them and not take advantage of the safety deposit box down in the hotel lobby. That's right. Something. If people have never taken advantage of that, they really should start doing so. You know, I'm finding that more and more hotels are, in fact, going to the networked locks. I tend to travel frequently with Hilton, for example, and I would say that more than half of the properties I stay in now, when I do the advanced check-in, they offer me the digital lock check-in, where they're actually using my smartphone as the key. It's a Bluetooth-based proximity key that they program in via the wireless connection. So this is a problem that ultimately will go away, but in the process of leaving, it's offering tons of lessons for people who are mixing network security and physical premises security. And as you say, the basic thing is just assume that your physical perimeter is every bit as porous as your cyber network perimeter is.
Right, right. Oh, I do want to move on, but I'll leave you with a little antidote. Anecdote. I can never say that properly. I was recently outside of the United States doing some work somewhere else in a very secure area, or supposedly very secure area, and they had some of the most advanced locks I had ever seen that required a card, required a fob, and a key code in order to enter. And I was actually thoroughly impressed because this is sort of an older area that's been retrofitted. But then just for giggles one night, I decided to type in 1234 and hit the pound button without any of the other things, and it opened the door. So you can have the most advanced technology, but if you don't set it up right, folks, you might as well not be there. Let's go ahead and move on to the second bite. Now, this I do want to get to because it is important and it is happening right now. Now, a lot of people may not realize that, yes, net neutrality was repealed. Yes, the FCC voted to get rid of it, but no, it hasn't actually been repealed yet. It's still the law of the land because the FCC hasn't actually pulled them back. They voted to rescind them. They voted to reverse, but ISPs are still bound by the rules of net neutrality, which is interesting because net neutrality at the state level is piling up in expectation of the FCC actually rolling that back. Now, a California bill that would impose the nation's strictest state net neutrality law is being replicated in a New York state legislature. So they're talking to one another and they're saying, look, we need to present a comprehensive and consistent front to the FCC to tell them that this is what we want. In California, the bill was approved last month by two Senate committees, despite protests from AT&T and cable lobbyists, who both said that they would fight this tooth and nail, that basically they would go to the bottom of their coffers to make sure it did not become law. It needs to go through one more committee before getting a vote of the full state Senate. But today, a lawmaker in New York said he teamed up with the California bill's author to introduce the same bill, an equivalent bill, in the New York legislature. Now, they're calling this a bi-coastal effort to restore the rights, quote, of an open and free internet through net neutrality legislation, unquote. Now, if that succeeds, that means that one law between California and New York would cover one-fifth of all Americans that are served by ISPs. Now, Chibert, this is actually a big thing. I mean, this is the coast, the big coast states, sort of flexing their muscles and saying, okay, look, you don't have to listen to us, but you do have to listen to our legislation.
Well, the reason why I kind of like the thing about piling on is I am starting to hear rumblings. And believe me, they're just rumors at this point. But I'm hearing rumors that this is actually going to happen in the four largest, most populous states in the United States. It's not going to be just California and New York. Texas and Florida are also thinking about jumping on the bandwagon. Now, the interesting thing is these guys are actually starting to talk about standardizing the state-level net neutrality bill across any state that wants to do this. They're actually kind of open-sourcing their bill. And the idea behind this is that this will actually battle one of the ISP's biggest complaints about having to deal with this massive spaghetti of legislation across all these states. Well, if they're all the same language, all the same rules, shut up.
Right, exactly. And that's been one of the things that we've heard from the lobbyists, which is we can't navigate 50 states. Well, if all 50 states agree to put the same plan into effect, you don't have to. And that argument becomes moot. Now, Curtis, this bill was sponsored in California by Senator Wiener and in New York by Brad Hoyleman, both Democrats. It seems to be a partisan thing. I mean, it's in some cases you've got Republicans jumping on the bandwagon as well. But is this just a populist response to a bill that maybe wasn't understood but has become a rallying cry against a Republican FCC? Or do you see this as truly something that people will start to understand once they see what they might lose with the removal of net neutrality? They're going to want it from their state.
I think that today it is largely an anti-Republican conservative move. It's something that's seen as something that a more liberal, more progressive state can do to sort of declare its independence from what's happening on the federal level. That's why I am less confident about Florida and Texas joining, since both of these states have Republican majority legislatures and Republican governors. With that said, I think that it could very easily become an issue in the off-year elections that we're about to have. And I do think that as some of the prices start to go up for levels of service that a year ago were free or were included in the basic package, we will begin to see more and more people start to understand exactly what net neutrality was. It's far more than just a buzz phrase. Yeah. I think as people begin to see that, then the calculus at the state level could change in some fairly profound ways.
Now that's what I'm hoping for, because if you remember when we first brought net neutrality up on This Week in Enterprise Tech, what, almost 4 years ago when it started entering to the public consciousness, there was no party attached to it. In fact, we were arguing that an Obama-appointed commissioner was essentially destroying the previous rules of the internet that were more or less neutral. It wasn't about party. It was about, this is just not good policy. If you don't regulate these networks and you don't get them to see that they're part of a larger network and that they serve the public good because they contracted to do so, then it becomes this partisan mess. And I unfortunately, I'm with you. I think there's a lot of people who are on one side of the net neutrality debate or the other simply because of party. And it's really not a party thing. Some have turned it into a party weapon, into a party issue. But it's really about those people who understand how networks work, saying, if you want this, if you want X, Y, and Z that you have been enjoying, you need net neutrality. And that's really what it comes down to. And that's what I'm hoping that Twyatt will continue to explain to the masses. Well, gentlemen, that does it for The Bites. Next up is my favorite part of the show. It's when we bring in a guest who can drop some knowledge on the Twyatt riot. Now, imagine this. Imagine that you could have a device that you could place at the edge of a network. And you could see exactly what users see because it's imitating a user. It's giving you all the metrics of how a user would be using your network, your services, your servers. Well, folks, that's not science fiction. That's NetBees, and they're on next. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we understand that passwords are hard. We get it. There are all these best practices about what we should and should not do with our passwords. Don't write them down on a post-it note and put them into our wallet or on top of the monitor. Do change them often enough, but don't change them so often that you'll forget them. Make sure to not bug your IT manager, because he might eventually do something really bad when you have to reset your password every other day. Now, these are all things that have just become common wisdom. But what if I told you that there was a way to make sure that you had strong passwords, that you had passwords that were not repeated across sites, that you had passwords that were protected enough so that you could use them in your enterprise, outside of your enterprise, and all across your digital life? Well, that's not a fantasy. That's LastPass. Now, this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. LastPass keeps your passwords organized and secure, and most importantly, right at your fingertips. Now, there are too many passwords to remember. Whether it's managing your personal accounts or securing your workplace credentials, LastPass endears to make password security effortless. You just remember your master password, and LastPass generates the rest. Now, by reusing the same password over and over, we know that that creates a huge security hole. LastPass generates and stores strong, unique passwords for each site, for each service, to keep you safe and secure. LastPass automatically remembers and then fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on your computer or on a mobile device. It also lets you explore the LastPass vault. This is actually one of my favorite features. Yes, it's good that it gives me strong passwords. And yes, it gives me that sort of one-point access to all of my information. But the fact that I can look at all the different sites that I've been using on LastPass, all those sites that are active, maybe those sites that I haven't used in years, and then decide what I want to do with them, that makes LastPass worth it in spades. Now, LastPass Enterprise simplifies password management for companies of every size with the tools that we need to secure our businesses while centralizing control of employee passwords and apps. Did you know that over 81% of breaches are caused by weak passwords? Actually, with this audience, you probably know that. I mean, that's something that is just common knowledge. The user is the weakest link. Well, LastPass lets you end that. It protects every password in your business without slowing down your employees. LastPass makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. Now, sensitive data is encrypted at the device level with AES 256 encryption to protect from man-in-the-middle attacks. Now, and LastPass has other products besides Enterprise for Business. There's LastPass Premium for personal use. There's LastPass Families for your entire family. There's even LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less. No matter how big or how small, you'll find a plan that works for you. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to stop post-it noting your passwords all over the place. At work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass. It's the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit. That's LastPass.com/twit today. Again, that's LastPass.com/twit, and see which product is right for you. And we thank LastPass for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We welcome to the show, a person who Chibert and I knew from way back when, in the interop days, before interop ITX, Mr. Panos Vouzis from NetBees. Panos, thank you very much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Hi, Padre. How are you? Nice seeing you again after the interop era.
That must have been, 6 or 7 years ago?
The last one I attended was 2015. I know you guys have a longer history with interop, right? But yeah, the one that NetBees participated with the team there was 2015 and 16, actually, but I missed that because my baby came to life.
Ah, yeah, well, babies tend to do. Actually, we just had a birth in our office, and work has basically stopped because everyone wants to see the baby. So that's a networking thing. Now, Panos, we're not here to talk about babies. Well, actually, we are. We're here to talk about your baby, the NetBees baby, and it's a specific way to actually see performance through the eyes of a user. We've got all sorts of tools that can give us metrics about what's going on our network. How loaded are our servers? How loaded are our switches? You know, where is their traffic congestion? But NetBees was unique in that you basically gave us a deployable end user. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, of course. So the whole idea behind NetBees is that we make sure that you capture the user experience, right? So you mentioned that every modern enterprise now has a handful of tools already in their arsenal for SNMP monitoring, NetFlow monitoring. And these are very useful, of course, and indispensable tools, right? You need to know if your router fried. However, you don't know with just SNMP or NetFlow what's the user experience behind the router at the remote site, especially when you don't have any local IT there to give you solid information about the status of your network. So in our case, the way we close that gap in network monitoring is by using sensors. So we deploy around your network at each remote site a sensor. So just to show you how it looks like, it's a small device like this. We use actually the Raspberry Pi platform for our hardware sensor. And all it does is that it connects to your network on the access layer and runs active monitoring tests simulating user experience. So it's like having a user 24/7 reporting to you, hey, I'm okay, thumbs up, or not okay, thumbs down, so come and take a look.
Oh, when you say simulating user experiences, what are you doing inside the box? So I understand it's built on the Raspberry Pi platform, and that's an incredibly powerful, incredibly flexible platform. And more importantly, it's low cost enough where I could put them all over my network. Mm-hmm. But what are you doing to simulate a user's activity?
Exactly. So the price, of course, is different, but you have to think about what is important for, let's say, a user's daily routine, right? They need to access, let's say, the internet. They need to access Salesforce, some internal applications running your data center. So what do we do from that sensor, from that device? We run active tests. So we check every few seconds, what's the latency to your data center? What is the bandwidth? What is the HTTP response time of your application server? And from that, we can say that, okay, the experience now of the user also in that specific location is as supposed to be, or if not, we can let you know about it.
Right. And so let's take a situation that I think every IT person who's watching our show will have had at some point. That is, you're sitting down in the data center in the depths of your building, and you get a call from a user who's yelling at you and not giving you much useful information, but essentially saying, your network is broken because I can't access blah, 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 blah. You now have the ability to get, say, Shell into one of these probes and say, no, it's working just fine. It must be your computer, or it must be you, or it must be your service. Is that the kind of power that you're going to be giving to the IT folk?
Exactly, yes. So when that happens, what you just described, you have a couple of options. So the IT person is going to maybe pick up a phone and try to go into a rabbit hole of troubleshooting with the remote user who's not technical. They don't know how to run a ping test, a trace route, right? And now they don't have also concrete information about when the problem started. You don't have historical information about the performance of the user experience. And in that case, what happens is that you can do two things. One is to have monitoring, continuous monitoring tests on the NetBeans device, which tells you what your baseline of performance. And as soon as, let's say, a service disruption happens or degradation in performance, within seconds you will get an alert, and you will be able to jump on an issue even before the user knows about it in many cases.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, now let me take a step back, because I remember the first time I heard about this idea, I said, oh my gosh, that's awesome. And actually, there had been a couple of other companies, Fluke included, that tried to turn something into a product like this. It always ended up either too expensive or didn't do enough. Give me the genesis of what you've created. Why did you decide to go with the Raspberry Pi? Why mm-hmm. did you go with the feature set that you have? Why did you go open source?
Exactly. So everything started 5 years ago, and I guess I would call it was a perfect storm, because the idea, I would say, is not like crazy or unique, right? We've spoken with many engineers over these years, and many have said, oh, I thought about this, or I tried to build it, you know. But what happened 5 years ago was that actually this platform came out in the market, the Raspberry Pi platform, which gave you a very low cost single board computer, a Linux box that you could use as a hardware sensor, right? And that gave you the ability to scale this sensor-based monitoring to dozens or hundreds of locations without having to pay thousands and thousands of dollars per, let's say, a pizza box server to run your software. So then, of course, the whole idea and concept came from our CEO, who was a network engineer. And again, when he was the big healthcare organization, he had all these different fancy tools at his disposal, but he didn't have a simple and effective way to capture user experience, right? And then that's where he put together a team, and we started working on NetBeans. 5 years later, we have now deployments in customers around the world with thousands of hundreds of locations that are using our sensors to monitor, again, what's going on from the user experience at the remote site.
You've definitely got the imagination going of the people in our chat room. Like JJ to the 484 is a very good question. You said, okay, so if you're going open source and if you're using a Raspberry Pi, where are you making your money? And that's an important question. That's not a throwaway. It's because, well, if you're a business, you have to be making your money somewhere, and they want to know where it's coming from. So what's your model?
Exactly. The open source part is that you can use, for example, your own Raspberry Pi. You can buy it for $35 off the shelf and put our software on it. So you have a sensor now that you can use to monitor your remote site or even your home, right? Where the business part comes in is that the central server, where all this data is collected, and you need the orchestrator to build statistics, build reporting, right? That's where the enterprise product comes in, which gives you the ability to have a scalable solution, right, to hundreds of these devices, and centrally managed and maintained without you having to do all this manual work. The part we sell, I would say, is the central server, because honestly, we don't even charge for the hardware we give, because it's so low cost. It's just the service and, of course, support and everything around it.
Right. And that answers RJP's question. He wanted to know if there was a pre-made image. So, yes, you could just install this on your own Raspberry Pi.
Mm-hmm.
A more geeky question from our chat room is, if you will be expanding to other platforms, like if someone wants to have a bit more power, will you be moving beyond a Raspberry Pi?
Yeah, actually, the Raspberry Pi, after all, is just a Linux box, Debian-based, or actually there are other flavors of Linux that can run on it. And you can use, if you want to have a bigger, more powerful always Linux-based computer, okay, so always go open source, you can install our package on your existing machine, right? So you can use a software agent that...
What distro is it, by the way? I need to ask that.
You mean the image we provide?
Right. So what distribution of Linux are you using as the underpinning of it?
Yeah, we mostly work on Debian-based.
Okay.
Ubuntu, Debian. So you can use either the Debian package we provide. You can also use a virtual image agent. Again, you can download from our website. You can spin it up as a VM in your data center, even as a VBox on your laptop, and have that as well as an option for a software agent, as well as cloud, right? If you want to install an agent in Azure, AWS, Google, you can also do that by just spinning up our cloud image.
Okay, now you did mention a phrase that does tend to set off our audience, that you'd be collecting data, and I understand why you're doing it, so that I can generate the reports, but then I have to ask, what do you do with that data? Is there any guarantee that you're not going to sell it, that you're going to keep it secure? What responsibility do you have to me collecting the data from my probes around my network?
Data is the hot topic these days, right?
Oh, yes.
Right. So there are, for very sensitive customers, like a secure aware, you can also go with an on-premise server. So you can take our server, install it on your own data center, and have everything, the sensors, the data, and the server, and all the communication between them on your own network. So in that case, we don't have any visibility in your data. Of course, we have a cloud service as well, and in that case, we maintain that. So two things there. Each customer has their own dedicated image as a server instance. So there is no risk there of, spilling data from one customer to the other, or if you have a breach, at least is isolated. And also the other thing is that the communication, of course, between the server and the device is encrypted, and we don't collect any personal information. So the information we collect is about network performance.
Just performance data, right?
Yeah. So you know latency, bandwidth, but it's not like we don't collect any user information. We don't touch that.
Well, these are all edge devices. These are all edge devices, so that the sensitive information is not even passing through them. This is literally just as if it was a user sitting at the edge of a network, and you're timing how long it takes for a connection to establish, or what kind of throughput it's getting.
Yeah, we don't do any packet capturing, any net flow, right? So it's generated data by the device that's only stored on the device and also on the cloud service.
Fantastic. Oh, Panos, I want to bring my co-hosts back into the conversation because I know I can see them in my monitors are kind of bouncing around. We love it when you get to play with gear like this. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we've been talking about performance metrics, specifically about having probes at the edge. But that's not the only place that you need to measure the performance of your network. You need to make sure that you have monitoring software and hardware in your network. Now, that's a good start. But the question is, what do you do with the information you get from those tools? You need to make sure that you've got something intelligent, something that will give you that single pane of glass so you can look up and say, this is a problem I need to deal with right now. These are issues I can deal with later. Well, I'm so happy that we've got one of those vendors in Moogsoft. Now, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Moogsoft. IT people know how it is. When all those alerts and tickets light up your monitor like a Christmas tree, you aren't being productive. You're just stressed out. You look up and you see the sky falling. No mere mortal can analyze all of those alerts and respond to all those tickets. Well, good news. You can immediately reduce that noise with the Moogsoft AI Ops. Now, Moogsoft AI Ops is an algorithmic IT ops platform that reduces your IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%. Imagine 99% of that noise disappearing and being left with only the actionable information. And this is guaranteed. Now, Moogsoft's AI Ops platform integrates with all of your existing IT tools. No forklift update required. Its patented technology correlates events into actionable work items called situations so that you can focus on tackling the stuff that matters. Now, HCL Technologies, that's a global IT managed service provider, includes Moogsoft AI Ops as the event management layer within its award-winning Dry Ice platform. This has helped its clients streamline operational workflows and reduce time in the detect-to-correct lifecycle of incident tickets. HCL experienced a 33% reduction in mean time to restore, enabling them to support more customers with service quality while keeping operational costs low and efficiency high. It's not just a theoretical. This is an actual customer who uses MOOCsoft to reduce the number of false alerts and the level of noise that might draw their IT resources where it's not required. Now, with MOOCsoft AI Ops, you can reduce your IT alerts and tickets by up to 99% right now. Just visit MOOCsoft.com to get a demo. That's MOOCsoft.com. MOOCsoft.com to get a demo. And we thank MOOCsoft for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and bring my co-host back into the party, Chibert. This is an idea that we've played with a lot at Interrupt, mostly because we get bored and we just start messing around with hardware. But the end user simulator is kind of one of those holy grail type things where it would be great if you could get the perfect one, but we haven't seen the perfect one just yet, right?
Yeah, man. You know, the bees guys have been the bee's knees. It's been really good. In fact, one of the I couldn't resist. Sorry.
You need more painkillers, T-Bert.
The number one complaint that we've always had at Interop was the wireless stinks at such and such classroom or whatever. So Stefano especially actually started working with us. We put in dual band Wi-Fi USB adapters onto those same Raspberry Pis, and we stuck them into the problem classrooms. So because it's open source, because Panos and Stefano and all those guys are so agile at being able to make changes, we were able to do a lot of customization so that we could more accurately meet the needs of portraying the end user experience, even in as large a venue as the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. But that's not all. Have I got a deal for you? Stefano actually worked with me, and we stuck a version of their software onto a BeagleBone Black. And the reason why we did this is because the number one area of single board computers failing is actually those SD cards. It's actually the mechanical connection where the fingers slide around. Mm-hmm. So the BeagleBone Black has disk on chip for their primary. So it's much, much, much more reliable. Because doing a service call 3 miles underwater is a real bummer. So this May-June timeframe, two BeagleBone Blacks with NetBeast software are going to go 3 miles under at the Aloha Cabled Observatory, and I'm going to have a dashboard so I can figure out what the heck is going on at the edge of my underwater observatory.
See, it's use cases like that that just they get me excited. Curtis, it's not all just an IT person trying to cover his or her ass. This is actual intelligence that you could use, where you could proactively go out to the edges of your network, even to your different branches, and see what does your performance currently look like?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that is, again, sort of the holy grail on maintenance and administration for a network is being able to deal with an issue before it becomes a problem. And having monitoring devices like the NetBees take you a long way in that direction, because the last thing you want is to find out that you've got a problem when you start getting calls from your users. You want to know and be working on it well ahead of that first call. So things like the NetBees are magic tools for network administrators, network managers, who actually want to stay on top of things and have a metric where they try to drive the angry calls from users as close to zero as possible.
Oh, Panos, I got to ask, just for personal interest here, have you done any pen testing of a NetBees node? I mean, could I drop this thing into the middle of Black Hat or DEF CON and just use it to measure security performance without worrying about it getting owned?
Well, that's a challenge now. the thing with the device specifically, the NetBeast device, they don't have any ports open, okay. Right? So, and other than 22, a false SSH, which, you know, can close on demand, and also the communication between the device and the server is outbound from the device
right.
to the server, right?
That's the way
so
to do it.
They don't have any input, any ports open listening. So now DEF CON, I don't know what they do there, but I cannot like guarantee anything.
Well, the problem is at DEF CON, you could almost guarantee that someone will get physical access to the device,
yeah.
and then all lights are off. But you're right. No, that's the right way to do it. So all outbound connectivity, no ports open, no services available to the outside world. And it's encrypted communication, so even if you were man in the middle, all you'd see is garbage. Not bad. Okay. Now, in a typical deployment, let's talk about the 10,000-seat enterprise that we always use as our sort of default example. How many of these, how many probes, how many nodes would I want, or how do I do that kind of calculus? Is one enough? Is 1,000 enough? Do I need to make sure that I cover every type of user experience I have? What's the typical metric that you give to potential users as to how many they should deploy throughout their network?
Yeah, so we don't go by user count or employee count. We go by location count. And when we talk about location, how you define that, right? So a location can be, let's say, a remote office in that has a few people in a call center in New York, or it can be a big data center in Texas, right? So the devices usually are installed on the edge router in most cases, right? Or the access layer where the user is, and can also be Wi-Fi or wired. So on the wired side, I would say you need one per network location. And on the wireless side now, because, of course, the wireless reception and the wireless communication is restricted by the radius of the access point, you have to think about installing, for example, a handful, I would say, per big network location. If you have like 100 or 150 people in an office, then you need probably 5 of these devices at the 4 corners of your big open space and one in the middle just to capture the core areas. And that's kind of the rule of thumb we use when we guide our customers how many to use and at what count at each location.
Nice. And I don't normally do this, but I'm kind of excited. What kind of pricing options do I have? Let's say I just want to get started. I want to see what one will do at one of my remote locations, say, oh, I don't know, in Rome. What am I looking at to start up? And then how do I scale and expand?
Sure, yeah. So we have right now some pricing on our website. We have some basic plans to get started that give you the ability to use a cloud dashboard with 5 or 10 devices. They start for the cloud for 5 devices is $180 per month for 5 of them. And you're going to go to 10 is around $330. And then there's like an add-on for Wi-Fi. That's for small starter packages. Now if you're going to go to enterprise, of course, for bigger installations with dozens or hundreds of agents, there is a volume price, which also the price per device goes much lower, obviously, right? And then, of course, other parameters like on-premise server or cloud server. But the core idea is that you have to think about maybe per device per year, a few $100s if you go to volume.
Okay. And are you considering maybe containerizing this or virtualizing it so that I could run it on Azure or AWS just to sort of, you know, check in every once in a while and make sure that I'm actually getting what I'm paying for?
That's in the works, actually, yes. Containerized agent and as well as the server, which is not visible to the user, but it's something that we're working on to release in the next couple of months.
Fantastic. Panos, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been so much fun. You know, it's nice to see folks from the old interop days coming through, especially when they're still representing the same company, the same technology. I'm so glad that you've continued with this. I'm so glad that you're continuing to improve it. Now, if you could, please tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find NetBees, maybe where they can go to download one of those images so that they could at least try it out and see what it might do for their network.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great seeing you all three. I remember the interop days that all of us were there at the NOC Center trying to support everybody. And yes, I mean, you can go to netbiz.net, of course. There you can find lots of information around the product and what it offers. And then if you want to give it a shot by yourself, you can go, if you go under plans, you can look at the different options. We have a free tier if you want to go with that and try it on your own Raspberry Pi. But also feel free to contact us, request a demo to talk to one of our people to explain in more detail what plan may fit your needs better. And we'll be happy to talk about that.
Fantastic. We have been speaking with Panos Vouzis. He's the Chief Operating Officer of NetBees. We thank you for joining us, and hopefully you'll be invited back to a future episode when we can talk about monitoring, because I love your approach, and it is a unique product that a whole lot of people are doing endpoint management and monitoring. Panos, thank you again for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you all. Always available.
Folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 endpoint monitoring devices. I want to thank everyone who makes the show possible. Of course, to Panos for giving us time to come in and talk about NetBees, but also to my co-hosts. Without them, I wouldn't want to do this show. They're incredible people. They're good friends. And, well, they've just been doing this a long, long time. Curtis, let's start with you. I know that you're an interop. You're in Las Vegas right now. You're heading home. Hopefully, you'll have a real house, like a real boy, really soon, and your own studio. But where can people find your work?
Well, as always, people can find most of my work over at Dark Reading. That's darkreading.com. And I will let people know when I've got new things published there on Twitter at KG4GWA. And just so you know, we did have, while not the knock of years past, we did have a great demo lab on IoT stuff at Interop this year. I'm going to have an article on that up this weekend and some video up about it next week. So come by, see what we were doing with the Internet of Things at Interop.
Thanks, Curtis. Always a pleasure. And, of course, my good friend, the Chibert, the geek in paradise, also right now, I guess he would be the love drug guy because he looks way too happy. In his care. I don't know what you've taken during the show, Chibert, but it was good. Do more of it. How can we find you and your work, and when will you be back up on your feet?
My Twitter is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. I finally did get the word. It is a really big tear in my gastrocnemius tendon.
Ouch.
Unfortunately, surgery doesn't work, and it's not bad enough for them to risk stem cell. So it looks like I'm going to be on crutches and then a cane for a long time. We're talking maybe as much as half a year.
Whoa. So probably no air travel for you for a while.
Don't know. All I know is that I've got a wedding in Vermont in October.
Oh, just the other side of the country. Okay, yeah, no problem. Yeah,
I got to make sure I'm well enough to travel for that. And I'm really thinking it'd be very cool. Drive to Boston and then catch the Dome train, the Amtrak Dome train from Boston down to Orlando to go visit the Sunshine Studio.
Well, he is going to be the limping geek in paradise for a while. Chibert, hopefully you'll make it over to Rome too, because we've got, I hear, like miraculous water or something. I don't know. I'm not really good on that.
Maybe
stuff.
We can get the Pope to lay his hands on my calf.
my mom asked me what is the best way to meet the Pope. I said, oh, it's actually really simple. Go to one of the public audiences and have a child. Just hold a child up, because he is attracted to children because he loves to bless them. He loves to make them smile. So there you go. That's the secret to the Vatican. Folks, thanks to all of our guests, all of our hosts, but also to you. That's right. To the person who comes by every week. Without you, we don't have a show, and you have supported us for so many years. We want to do something for you. We want to make it easier for you to get all of your enterprise goodness. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiet. That's TWIET. There you'll find all of our back episodes, as well as our notes. So if you want to learn a little bit more about a story we talked about in our blips or a bite. So if you want the contact information for our guests, you can find it there at twit.tv/Twyatt. While you're there, why not subscribe? You can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version into your device of choice each and every single week automatically. It's the best way to support the show and perhaps a way for you to tell your friends to jump on to the Twyatt Riot train. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter when I'm not here. That's twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you'll find out what I do when I'm not in the studio. You'll find out when I'm traveling across the world, across the country, and what other interests I might have when I'm up late at night and I just decide to make stuff. Again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing Twyatt all these years, to our engineers who make sure that everything is plugged in properly, to Alex, Jammer B, and to Burke, and of course to our TD. Normally it's the Shark Boy, but today it's Alex. Now, Alex doesn't get a question of redemption because he's known by a different name. He's the Heart of Darkness. He's the black hole at the center of the Twit Galaxy. Alex, would you like to say a few words to the audience?
Excuse me, Padre, that's Kevin.
He always keeps me on my toes. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit. Just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.